Let me first tell you who some of my co-conspirators are on this. Basically, all this work's been done in collaboration over many years with Vic Emery, and more recently in collaboration with Eduardo Fratkin. Various pieces of the work I'll tell you about today were done in collaboration with Oren Zakhar, who's here. And Dror God and Erica Carlson and Vadim, who's also here. Some with Tom Lubensky and ZX Shen, the student Zhou, and Marcus Alcola. And then at the end, I'm going to get to some old work and some new work that's related to this that's been done in collaboration with Shadeep Chakravarti. This problem of high-temperature superconductivity is so hard that you end up having to think about what your philosophy is and what are important questions and what you want to do. And I think it's important to at least tell you what I'm after. So that's what the purpose of this transparency is. So the first thing is that I think that this field is called high-temperature superconductivity for a reason. We're really interested in physics on the scale of TC. We're interested in why is TC so high? And we're, since there's very good empirical evidence that the normal state is not normal in the sense of being a good Fermi liquid, it means we have to understand how the superconducting state emerges from the non-Fermi liquid normal state. And so, for instance, we'd like to understand the sorts of spectral changes that occur as you cool from above to below TC. Of course, one of the most exciting things one can ask about is, are there new phases? In this case, new phases of highly correlated electronic systems. And there have been various proposals for new phases, some of which come out of the line of reasoning that I'll be describing. And so that's certainly an interesting thing to look for. And along with that comes another thing that I think is getting more and more attention recently. I think STRIPES in many ways is the first example of this that thrust itself on our consciousness. But these ideas, I think, are playing a more and more important role, which is that when you have these strongly correlated systems, there seem to be a large number of competing phases. And one would like to try to understand the problem in some sort of organic fashion where these are not just things that are added on after the fact, but emerge in some organic way from the description of the problem. Okay, so those are the sorts of questions. And now I want to tell you what I consider to be, what I consider would be a satisfactory theory to come to grips with these. So the first thing is that I think that because the experiments are so complex, it's very dangerous to justify theory by appeal to experiment. I think to start with, the theory has to have an internal logic. That is to say that the theoretical statements that one makes should be demonstrably correct solutions of the stated model, and then we can fight about whether the model is reasonable or not.
Seems like pretty high standards.
Yeah. No, I agree with you, but I think it's important. I think it's called for here because it's terra incognita. Then, of course, that's not enough. This isn't an abstract problem. There must be some physical correspondence between the model solved and physical reality. And there are two levels of this. One is the level of adiabatic continuity. That is to say, you've got to have the right phases. And that's a very sharp question. Either you're in the right phase or you're not. But something can be very far from the physics and still be in the right phase. The example I like is if we take protons and electrons, At high temperature, they form a plasma, which has basically perfect conductivity. At lower temperatures, they form an ideal gas that basically has zero conductivity. There's no phase transition, so these are adiabatically connected to each other. But you really wouldn't want to treat the problems of an ideal gas starting from a plasma. They're so different, they're even studied in different departments. So you want somehow that the problem you're solving is close, in some sense, to the physical problem being addressed, that is to say, to reality. And then finally, the theory should make some concrete and testable predictions for experiment, but I think also for numerical experiment. And I think this maybe hasn't been emphasized as much as it should be. You know, numerical experiment is limited to small systems. And so there are certainly many questions that we can't ask of numerical experiment. But if you make a length scale from some sort of superconducting coherence length, which you can estimate various ways or take your favorite experiment to estimate, but it gives you some sort of size that's on the order of 30 to 100 latticites, and that's the sort of size that numerical people can now study. So that the physics that determines the pairing, which is after all an important ingredient of superconductivity, is already testable by experiments. You know, you might say that the physics of TC, where I make a length scale by taking some estimate of the Fermi velocity and dividing it by TC, is still too big. But at least to try to get some idea of what's the physics of pairing, I think the numerical studies are clearly big enough and should be, must be addressed.
Can I ask a really naive question? What is the meaning of VF if it's a non-Fermi liquid? It's like the Fermi velocity, if it were a Fermi liquid.
Yeah, so maybe you want to take this to be the bandwidth over TC times a lattice constant. Or, you know, along the nodal direction, there's something, which we can argue about whether it's a quasi-particle or not, but there's something that disperses with a characteristic velocity that you can extract.
Okay, so this is the perpendicular thing that Chandravam was talking about the other day.
I wasn't here. I was going trick-or-treating with my kids, so I'm afraid. His talk wasn't on the web yesterday. I don't know why. I intended to be prepared, but I was foiled. Okay, so now, let me tell you about stripes, which is, in a sense, the starting point for everything that I'm going to talk about, but I'm not going to talk a lot about stripes per se. This is an old subject. Stripes are a form of charge order, and I believe there's good evidence that they're ubiquitous in lightly doped mod insulators. And what stripes consist of is some form of microphase separation where you have a inhomogeneous state that consists of hole rich regions, which I'll call the stripes, and hole poor regions. And I've been pestering everybody for a name for this, and the best name that's been proposed so far is interstripe. I won't tell you who proposed it until I see whether you like this or not. But anyway, so the charges are sort of free to move. They're more or less metallic in the stripe region and are more insulating in the interstripe. And there are many ways, many lines of reasoning that lead to this. There's the frustration of the whole kinetic energy in an antiferromagnet. There's Coulomb interactions. There's phonons. Many considerations lead to this sort of conclusion. There is an important difference, which is that you can either imagine that these stripes are somehow insulating, as they would be in a more conventional charge density wave, or metallic, as I've been describing them. And that's the viewpoint I'm going to take. And there are a number of good review articles that talk about some of the evidence and some of the theory. I've given you two here. I also want to bring your attention to the fact that a very extensive study of the evidence of stripes in YBCO appeared on the web today by Herb Mook and collaborators. Um,
stripes appear in a lot of materials that are not superconducting.
They appear in lots of materials that are non-superconducting. This was part of my philosophical introduction. It got out of order. So before I go back to stripes, let me just say one other thing, philosophical, which is that once we are looking at non-universal physics, I mean, when we're looking at phases, there's right answers and there are wrong answers. But when we're looking at non-universal physics on the scale of TC, it's not completely obvious that there's one best way of looking at it from all points of view. And so for different aspects of the problem, there may be different useful ways of approaching the problem. And, you know, that's something that we should bear in mind before being too dogmatic in trying to kill each other. And the example I have in mind, for instance, is if you look at the pseudo-gap phase of a one-dimensional electron gas. Yeah, I didn't say we shouldn't kill each other. I think we should just pause before it.
We should do it with style.
Exactly. So you can look at the pseudo-gap phase of a one-dimensional electron gas. That is to say, there's a spin gap that opens up, but because of one dimension, the system doesn't order to zero temperature. Now, you can think of that pseudo-gap in the Luther-Emery liquid as being that the system really wanted to be a superconductor, but phase fluctuations of the superconductor prevented ordering down to zero temperature. Or you can think of it as the system wanted to order as a 2KF CdW, and the acoustic fluctuations of the CdW are what have kept it from ordering. And both of these explanations are right. There's no in principle way of distinguishing between them. You might say that where the superconducting susceptibility is the most divergent, that that might be the better way of looking at it. But there isn't really any sharp distinction between these two viewpoints. OK, good. So now I told you about stripes, and this was supposed to follow that. What I want to do is, rather than doing the usual thing of showing the structural evidence of stripes, what I want to do is to cut right to the heart of the matter, from my point of view, and show you evidence that, for whatever reason, I believe but because of stripes, but for whatever reason, there is a substantially one-dimensional character to the electronic structure of these cuprates. And basically, this is a picture of what the Fermi surface looks like in the Brillouin zone of a typical high-temperature superconductor. There are these antinodal regions here, which are very flat. There's no dispersion in the Fermi surface as a function of Ky. And that's, of course, what you, if you had a strictly one-dimensional system, you would have absolutely vertical Fermi surfaces. Whereas in the nodal regions, there's perhaps a more two-dimensional character to the Fermi surface. So there's, you know, just directly observed a quasi one-dimensional character to the Fermi surface. I'm also going to argue that there's evidence of electron fractionalization, especially in these regions of the Fermi surface. And I'm going to interpret that as well as being evidence of one-dimensional behavior, of course, although, of course, I don't have to tell you in this room that there may be other ways of getting electron fractionalization.
See, before you go on, if it doesn't hold you up too much, if I look at the antinodal region, if I'm to think of it as one-dimensional, then there should be strong dispersion in the direction perpendicular to the Fermi surface, right? That is to say, if I'm up near the Ky point,
right,
there should be strong dispersion along K.
Well, there should be dispersion, stronger dispersion.
Rather stronger dispersion.
Yeah.
You want to comment on the experimental evidence for that?
Well, there is.
But I mean, the dispersion is only, if I look at Ky, the dispersion is only along Kx and not along Ky.
Right.
It's stronger along Kx than
right,
along Ky.
Right, right. Let me show you. I don't have, I mean, I'll show you later after the talk if you want some things showing the dispersion in this direction. Let me just show you a few pictures that show you the lack of dispersion in that direction.
And by definition, if the lines are vertical.
Right. So this is, of course, a sketch. So here the lines are completely vertical. let me show you some data. Here's data on lanthanum, neodymium, strontium, copper oxide. Now, this is a stripe-ordered material, so there are certainly stripes here. And what you see are these, so here's the spectral function, integrated over some energy window of the Fermi surface. So if omega's small, you can think of this as being a picture of where there are states in the Brillouin zone with energy at the Fermi surface. And if so omega is big, you can think of this as a picture of where in the Brillouin zone there are occupied states. And so here is for lanthanum, neodymium, strontium, copper oxide with X, the strontium concentration 0.1. Here's integrated over a small energy window. So here's the 0, 0 point. Here's the 0 pi point, the pi 0 point, and the pi point. So these are these antinodal regions. And you see these very flat Fermi surfaces here. Here's the same thing integrated over a bigger energy window. And it really looks very substantially one-dimensional.
I'm not sure I understand the color scheme.
Oh, you know, this is intense, and blue is, you know, is empty, and yellow is intense. Here's the color scheme: minimum intensity, maximum intensity.
So you have a 30 millivolt window and a big wide yellow region.
Yeah. So there's a lot of, I mean, the dispersion isn't great here, and the spectral functions are broad. So even though there is dispersion here, they leak over into the Fermi surface region. So it's very not, I mean, in a Fermi liquid, you would see lines. Okay? You can analyze this data in a way that you see lines, but I want to show you unanalyzed data as much as possible.
Steve, should I be surprised that when omega goes by factor 10, the two pictures doesn't change that much?
Well, so in a Fermi liquid, what you would see, if omega was small, you'd see two lines here, say, and then as you increased omega, you would fill it in.
I see.
Now, the fact that it doesn't change so much is a reflection of the breadth of the spectral functions. I will interpret it as being a consequence of fractionalization, in fact.
So
yes, you should be surprised by this, I guess, is the answer.
But so I'm sorry, how does this answer, how do I see from this that the dispersion is very different this way?
You don't. I haven't showed you. Okay. I haven't showed you the dispersion in that direction. I've got it in another pile, and it would just take me a few minutes to shuffle through and show you pictures of the dispersion in the other direction.
How can you even talk about dispersion?
What?
How can you even talk about dispersion for something this broad?
Yeah, well, that's why you have to look at the picture, and you have to look at the picture and see, do you see something or other that disperses? And the answer is, you know, there is some identifiable velocity, but there's not a well-defined quasi-particle peak. I mean, you know, even in the one-dimensional electron gas, if you look at the spectral functions, as I'll show you later, you see velocities. They're not the velocity of a quasi-particle, but they're the velocity of something, and they show up in the spectral function.
But still, if you're trying to fit the spectrum along the transverse direction, say to some liquid form.
It fits beautifully. That's what I'll show you.
From which one can extract a velocity.
Yeah.
As you said.
Yeah.
And the question is how big that velocity is in the transverse
direction. Let me get to that. But it's not, you know, you can fit it to a lot of different things. I mean, the data is not great for that. So, you know, I don't. Okay, here's a picture of BISCO in the same way. This is presumably not a stripe-ordered material. This is optimally doped BISCO. This is old, low-resolution photoemission data. The data is actually taken at the crosses, and this picture is made by interpolating between the data at those points. But again, you see this very flat Fermi surface. In fact, from looking at the dispersion of features and where they go through the Fermi energy using, you know, some criterion or other, they extracted this for the Fermi surface. And again, you see that in these antinodal regions, the Fermi surface is extraordinarily flat. Here's a high-resolution picture in optimally doped BISCO. You're supposed to be looking at this, and it's for some reason not showing up very well. This is actually in the superconducting state. Here I'm plotting energy in this direction and momentum along the y direction here. And so you can look, since I'm in the superconducting state, there actually is a peak. That's this peak in the spectral function. And you can see that over an enormous width of k, it simply doesn't disperse at all.
But that peak doesn't even disperse in the other direction.
It does, Dandy. All right, I have to dig. It's clear I'm not going to be able to get past this point. This is superconducting peak, yeah. Why not? It's just... What?
I thought you were talking about an anomalous state.
I'm talking about both. I'm presenting for you evidence that this thing is substantially one-dimensional. Shoot.
The quasi-particle in the superconducting state is one-dimensional?
Just a second. Let me... Okay, so here's the data in the normal state going along this direction in optimally doped BISCO. And, you know, you can see that there's something or other. It's broad. It's not a Fermi liquid peak. But there's something or other that's dispersing with a noticeable dispersion. And here's the superconducting state where actually it gets somewhat flatter, as you would expect, because you're opening up a gap. Okay? This is from the same paper. No, it isn't. This is from a later paper, which I quote later. But
that's 6.74 possibility.
That Fermi surface doesn't look so far.
What? Yeah, it is. Look at that. Absolutely straight here. It is. But anyway, that's a sketch. So. Good. Well, all right.
Can you comment on the missing part of the straight line? After, you know, when the two lines cross, if it's one-dimensional, you should have like a cross structure.
No, I'm not.
Why not?
Well, because I don't know what to say. I mean, I can say various things. Here, if you want to look at this picture here, that's a calculation in some Hartree-Fock sense of what the symmetrized spectrum looks like of a stripe system. This was done in collaboration with Marco Salcola, and I should mention it was done before any of these experiments, so there's no finagling of parameters. And you see these very flat one-dimensional regions here, and they die for basically form factor reasons, not for dispersion reasons.
I'm confused. I mean, the flat region exists only over like 20% of the...
Yeah, so that's a form factor.
Why should we focus on that a little bit?
Well, that's what I want to focus on, okay? That's where the superconductivity arises. It's an important region. What am I doing? Oh, no wonder I'm having so much trouble. This is the wrong file.
So this is also a different philosophy from people that want to focus on the nodal region, nodons,
yeah, well, look, for the physics at the scale of TC, and certainly the scale of superconductivity, I think there's every reason to think that this is the region to focus on. The nodal quasi-particles, even in a conventional BCS picture, would play no role in the condensation. And empirically, as you go through TC, the nodal quasi-particles hardly change. I mean, the nodal spectral function hardly changes at all, whereas the spectral function near here has dramatic changes. So, you know, if you're looking at asymptotic low-energy physics, you certainly will want to focus on the nodal quasi-particles. But for the physics on the scale of TC, the questions are quite different. Okay. Okay. Okay, so what I'm going to do now is define a model for you, which I'm going to solve. Okay, so we're now, you can put your questions aside, you can bring them up when we fight over whether this has anything to do with reality. But I'm now going to tell you the model I'm going to describe. I'm going to describe a model which is a quasi one-dimensional system that consists of an alternating array of A and B type chains. So it's got stripes and interstripes and stripes and interstripes. The picture I have in mind is something like this. Here's a picture of a stripe ordered system. This is a so-called bond-centered stripe. This is a so-called site-centered stripe. That has to do, well, with whether it's bond-centered or site-centered. The picture is some picture of maybe some antiferromagnetic order or some antiferromagnetic correlations. The green is supposed to be a picture of the density of doped holes. And so in this picture, I might think that the stripe is somehow a doped two-leg ladder, and the interstripe is somehow an undoped two-leg ladder. And here I might think that the stripe is somehow a doped three-leg ladder, and the interstripe is a undoped or weakly doped one-leg ladder. So I'll consider those different cases. So here, this thing is doped. It's going to be either a doped two- or three-leg ladder, and hence, for reasons I'll describe, a Luther-Emery liquid. And this is going to be the interstripe region, which I'll talk about in a minute. And the Hamiltonian, then, is going to consist of a bosonized field theory limit of the one-dimensional electron gas on the isolated stripes and on the isolated interstripes. And that's the big part of my Hamiltonian. And then the small, which fortunately we can solve exactly. And then there's the small part, which is the higher dimensional couplings, which will be the small parameter that allows me to do good calculations.
Is the AA prime piece of the Hamiltonian induced or
included? Yeah, yeah. I mean, look, I'm going to put this all this stuff in by hand. Okay. You know, presumably at some early stage of renormalization, you generate all of these things. But, you know, this is more or less at the limit of what I can do. Okay. Now, there are some general things we know about quasi-one-dimensional superconductors, quasi-one-dimensional systems in general. So, first place, at high temperatures, you can ignore the couplings between chains. So, at high temperatures, the system exhibits one-dimensional physics. So, you know, as usual, we in condensed matter, we do things backwards. We have low dimension at high energies and high dimension at low energies. And so then in the ordered state, you cross over to higher dimensional physics because you can't have ordered states in one dimension. And so the ordered state, you certainly have to take into account the interchain couplings in some way. It's very almost unavoidable to find pseudo gaps in one dimension because of the lack of order in one dimension. So we'll have a crossover from, say, a Luttinger liquid at high temperatures to a Luther-Emery liquid at lower temperatures, and then a phase transition to a three-dimensionally ordered state. So in order to ask questions like, is this adiabatically connected to reality, we have to ask, first place, what's the ordered state? It better be superconducting or we're not in the right place. But we'll see that there's going to be an interesting competition between 2KF charge density wave order and superconductivity. It should probably be D-like in the sense that the pairing field changes sign under 90-degree rotations, even though that's not a symmetry, as opposed to S-like. These are not separated by a phase transition, by a crossover, but this is an important piece of the physics. But fortunately, we understand largely from work of Doug and his collaborators, that this is essentially unavoidable. And then finally, there's the issue of whether we have nodal quasi-particles or not. Now, in many people's minds, D-wave and nodal quasi-particles are the same thing. Unfortunately, they're not. You can see, for instance, just even in a conventional superconductor, if I had a Fermi surface that was closed around the pi zero points and lines of nodes for a dx squared minus y squared order parameter that went like this, there would be no point at which the excitation gap vanishes. I think that was pointed out, I don't know if it was first, but it was certainly pointed out in the early days of ITC by Schrieffer, Zhang, and Nguyen. So we're going to have to ask whether this thing supports nodal quasiparticles. In the past, when I've given this talk, this is one of the things Patrick has complained about. So I will answer you. Okay, let me go on a little bit more, reminding you about superconductivity in one dimension. So I can write down the usual zero momentum pair creation operator here. L and R refer to left and right, and up and down refer to spin up and spin down. And so there's the pair creation operator, and this can be bosonized. And when you bosonize it, you get something that depends on the spin fields and something that depends on the charge fields. Now, spin-charge separation is something that is near and dear to many of our hearts. It's a exotic and interesting, fascinating possibility in more than one dimension. But in one dimension, it's ubiquitous. There's nothing bizarre I'm doing here by separating charge and spin. That's valid in the long wavelength limit, almost independent of details. Here, phi is a field, and theta is the dual field. They satisfy canonical commutation relations like this. The other thing you can notice about this is that it sort of looks like the spin field plays the role. I mean, this is an operator equation, but still the spin fields, or the cosine of the spin field, plays the role of the amplitude of the order parameter, and the dual of the charge field plays the role of the phase of the superconducting order. So that when you freeze the spin fluctuations by opening a spin gap, you're enhancing superconductivity. Okay, so spin charge separation doesn't mean that the spin degrees of freedom don't come into superconductivity. They do. They come in, that's basically the physics of pairing. And then the interesting low dimensional physics has to do with the physics of phase ordering. Another way of saying that is that if you calculate the superconducting susceptibility, it's proportional to the spin gap, and then proportional to the temperature to some power that depends on a Luttinger exponent called K sub charge. And so this thing is divergent so long as 1 over K charge is less than 2. Now, this isn't something that's easy to compare with numerical experiments, because most numerical experiments can only calculate ground state properties. But fortunately, the pair-field correlator can be calculated at the same level. And it's, well, also proportional to the spin gap. But it falls off with a power law in space that's also determined by this Luttinger exponent. So we can actually measure this Luttinger exponent by looking at the fall off of pair-field correlations. OK, now I mentioned that there's an evil twin of superconductivity in one dimension, which is the dual order, the CDW order. That depends upon the spin fields in exactly the same way as the superconducting order, but it depends on the dual field of the superconducting phase. And so for that reason, its power law is determined by Kc as opposed to 1 over Kc. Okay, and so here you see concretely what I meant that at the beginning, that opening the spin gap I can think of as being somehow due to uncondensed CDW order or as due to uncondensed superconducting order, and there's literally no way of distinguishing. Okay, so great, this is good. In order to get superconductivity, it's clear I would like to have a big spin gap and a small 1 over Kc. And now we have to ask, where does the spin gap come from? What is the value of Kc? And in particular, there are going to be three ranges. One is, if 1 over Kc is bigger than 2, we're sunk. If Kc is between a half and 1, or 1 over Kc is between 1 and 2, the superconducting susceptibility is divergent, which is good, but the CDW susceptibility is more divergent, which sounds dangerous. And if Kc is greater than 1, then the superconducting susceptibility is the dominant one. So we want to know at least in which range does Kc land. And then finally, we have the sort of notion here that because of spin-charge separation, an idea which I like to call the short-range RVB idea, that the pairing scale, the spin gap, can be basically a property of a quantum disordered insulating state, and therefore impervious to the effects of long-range Coulomb interactions, so that there might be, here X is supposed to represent somehow whole concentration, so this is the undoped insulating system, maybe has a spin gap, and then that as we dope the system, that spin gap more or less survives, becoming along the way the superconducting gap. So that would be attractive, certainly. Okay, so let me tell you what I believe is the physics that generates the spin gap, the pairing. And this is the physics of the spin gap proximity effect. And the simplest thing to think of is I've got some sort of ladder, and I have two bands, either two different chains or a bonding, anti-bonding band or something, with different values of Kf. And now I ask, and repulsive interactions. And now I ask, what happens if I turn on the coupling between these two systems? Now, because of Kf not being equal to Kf prime, the sorts of couplings I can make between these two systems are very limited. Single particle tunneling simply doesn't occur because of the mismatch of Kfs at low energy. Antiferromagnetism with period 2KF, or CDW with period 2KF, can't lock from chain to chain. So really, the only potentially relevant coupling between these is the tunneling of zero momentum Cooper pairs. So the question is, first, is the dimension of the pair tunneling operator less than 2? Okay, well, there's some expression you can derive for the dimension of the pair tunneling operator. If one of these two systems already happens to have a spin gap on it, that dimension is smaller than if it doesn't, here by a additive factor of 1/2, as you can see. But anyway, it depends upon the nature of these things. But sometimes this is relevant and sometimes it's not relevant. Okay? Suppose it's relevant, what happens? Well, suppose it's relevant, then the whole system combines into one remaining system. It has a total spin gap. It has a value of Kf, which is the sum of the two Kfs, and it has a Luttinger exponent, which can be anything. Okay, let me just describe the physics of this. The physics of this is very close to the physics of the ordinary proximity effect, and hence the name. In a proximity effect, we take a superconductor and bring it up to a metal, and we induce pairing in the metal. Okay, now, why do we induce pairing in the metal? Well, the point is that because of the superconducting gap, electrons can't tunnel from the metal into the superconductor. So the electrons are confined in the metal, and that, of course, costs zero point energy. If I pair the electrons in the metal, even though that costs energy, you gain the zero point delocalization energy in the transverse direction, and that always wins in this case. That always drives the system to pair. Okay, now what's happening here is very much the same, although perhaps neither of these chains want to pair, or maybe one of them wants to pair. It pays to pair up the electrons on these chains, even though that costs energy, because you gain more energy by allowing the electrons to delocalize transverse to the chain.
Presumably this effect goes like Kf minus Kf prime, or something like this.
No. The point is that the competitors are dependent on Kf minus Kf prime, if you want.
Right.
This thing is independent of Kf minus Kf prime. So if Kf and Kf prime were close to each other, for instance, it might pay to transfer some electrons from this band to that band to make the two Kfs the same so that you could CDW order.
So then we would overwhelm this.
Right, that's possible. Yeah. But as long as these are different enough in scales of the strength of the interchain coupling, then this guy's the only possible winner. Okay, so here's a place where one can make very good contact with numerical experiments. There are very extensive and conclusive experiments on a small number of leg ladders by White and Scalapino and some others, but certainly they've pushed it farther than anybody else. And so first place, one finds that for the undoped two-leg ladder, there actually is a big spin gap. It's of order 1/2 the exchange energy. And moreover, as you dope the two-leg ladder, as long as you don't dope it too much, this gap, although it gets smaller, doesn't get wildly smaller for some range of doping. So one has a pairing gap, if you want, something that can serve as the superconducting gap. It's characteristic of the insulating state, so it's very big on the scale of pairing gaps. And this is very good. The same thing happens in more subtle ways on the three-leg ladder, which has no gap, which is gapless when undoped, but when doped in some intermediate doping range, develops a gap that's on the same scale as the gap in the two-leg ladder. And of course, as I mentioned before, all of the superconducting correlations on these things are D-like. Now, one other thing that we talked about was what was the value of KC. There's a paper I found from, again, by Scalapino and collaborators, where they looked at exactly this issue in the various versions of the two-leg ladder, and found that at least for some ranges of parameters, one can actually even have this thing less than 1. Okay, now I want to emphasize that the mesoscale structure, that is to say the narrowness of these ladders, is an extremely important part of this story. The first place, in every case I know, when you take an even leg ladder and dope it, the gap never gets bigger. So the gap in the undoped ladder is giving you some sort of an estimate of how big the gap can possibly be. And it was shown by Chakravarti some time ago that the gap on the 2N leg ladder actually drops exponentially with the width of the ladder. So once you get past the 2 or 3 leg ladder, you're just out of business. Okay, so this leads to the first and perhaps most important proposal, namely that this spin gap proximity effect mechanism on self-organized stripes, that is to say ladders, provides the mechanism of superconducting pairing.
Now, how do you jump from stripes to ladders so easily? I thought the ladders have nothing in between the two legs, but the stripes has all this other stuff.
No, so I'm looking at a single stripe, which I'm modeling as being a 2 or 3 leg ladder.
One stripe is one ladder.
One stripe is one 2 or 3 leg ladder. Yeah, I'll...
So it's not the interaction between the stripes.
No.
Within the stripe.
Within a stripe. Yeah. Uh-huh. The pairing. We'll worry about superconductivity. I haven't gotten us to superconductivity yet. I've gotten us some pairing out of repulsive interactions. I've gotten us pairing on a high scale. Okay, I think that's a step. But okay. Now, let me now talk about what happens as I couple stripes together. So that's called onset of order. And to start with, I'm going to make my life simple and make these interstripes into vegetables. Maybe these are undoped two-leg ladders, which have a gap in both their charge and spin degrees of freedom. So I just have now some ordinary quasi-one-dimensional system. Each of these A-type chains are now supposed to represent some sort of doped ladder, so they already have a spin gap. They're Luther-Emery liquids. Each one is described by a charge at low energy by a charge field and its dual superconducting field. Okay, and again, this is this typical quasi-one-dimensional picture. And now I ask, what happens as I couple these things to each other? Now, because of the spin gap, the number of couplings that I can put between these is very constrained again. Single particle tunneling is out. Anything involving magnetism is out. There's only two things that I have to worry about. One is zero momentum pair tunneling, the good guy. And the other is 2KF-CDW interactions, the bad guy. And there, their dimensions again. Now, we can, supposing, say that we only look at this one, we can estimate TC with extreme accuracy. It was shown a long time ago by Scalapino, Imrie, and Pincus that in the limit of extreme anisotropy, interchain mean field theory gives you an exact result for TC. Basically, because the correlation length in one dimension grows so large before the couplings between chains matter, that anything like a Ginsburg criterion or a Brout criterion will give you, will vanish in this quasi-one-dimensional limit. Yeah?
Why don't you have some kind of co-tunneling between those stripes?
What do you mean by co-tunneling?
Well, so you're saying that single particle tunneling is, is unimportant, but say from one stripe tunnel into another stripe kind of by meaning.
No, but there's a spin gap. So if I put an odd number of electrons from one stripe to another, it costs the spin gap, and so it can't possibly be relevant at low energy. I mean, gaps are a really good reason for things to be irrelevant.
Yeah. So the model is that the stripe is a two-leg ladder.
Say the stripe is a dope two-leg ladder, sure.
And the in-between stripe is also an even...
Is it an undoped even leg ladder here, for instance?
That's the only case when you have spin gap, right? If it's odd, then you have no gap.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. We'll get to more complicated cases later.
You're picturing everything even.
Everything even, yeah.
Steve, isn't it fair to say, though, if it were odd, say, a three-leg, you'd sort of have a pseudo-gap because of the bands, two of them wouldn't
gap.
Yeah, but for now, you see, I've put no degrees of freedom. There are no low-energy degrees of freedom living in the interstripe for now, just because... we're warming up. The grand finale is when I put in the interstripe degrees of freedom.
Steve, I'm lost. In this picture, where do I see the KF and the KF prime, the two different KFs?
They're lost. They're all inside. We're solving the problem like an onion. So we've already solved the two-leg ladder here. That's where there was the KF and the KF prime. Say, in the way that Balanz and Fisher did it, there's a bonding band and an anti-bonding band on the two-leg ladder, and they each have different KFs. And then they're coupled, and that produces a spin gap. Okay? But now at larger distances, all that's left on this stripe is a low energy charge degree of freedom, a single one. That's all that's left. KF, okay, I've got my new KF is the sum of those two KFs, and that's it.
Okay, so you started out with the two legs separate, and then you have a plus and minus combination.
For instance, yeah. 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 Yeah.
See, why KF and two leg ladder should be different if they make the same stripe?
No. KFs on every stripe is the same. That was the physics within a stripe.
The ladder is a single piece of stripe is your two leg ladder.
Yeah.
One KF is not equal to KF prime.
Because it's a bonding and anti-bonding band.
No, but I thought actually the whole argument about the spin gap was that actually you ignore all the charge density wave.
No, Doug told you that there was a reason why a region of parameters where it could have a spin gap.
No, it always has a spin gap, in fact.
I'm sorry, but a supercomputer.
What?
Yeah, and not other instabilities.
Well, no, for one dimension, it doesn't have any other instabilities. So this system is a Luther-Emery liquid. Okay, I don't want to redo the talk, but we understand this is a two-leg ladder. At the end of the day, after we cook it and beat it, it becomes a Luther-Emery liquid. Now forget about everything else. We're coarse-graining, and so we can't see anything that's happening in here. We're looking at the weak couplings at larger distances.
So even though this Luther-Emery liquid is forming from two-leg ladder with KF approximately equal to KF prime, nevertheless, you claim that it will be spin gap.
It's not approximately equal to KF prime, and it does spin gap. So. Okay?
Strong hopping between the two legs.
Bonding and anti-bonding.
I thought the single stripe is a two-leg ladder.
Yep. Yes.
The whole argument was that actually KF, not equal to KF prime, because I can't forget about all other terms.
Sasha, listen, you're wrong, okay? We'll talk about it later, but I got to go on.
Go on.
Okay, so So here's what happens if I try to order this. So here's this Luttinger liquid, Luttinger parameter. If I'm less than 1, then superconductivity is the dominant instability. If I'm greater than 1, then CDW is the dominant instability. Between 0.5 and 2, one of the or the other is a subdominant divergence. One would, using such a mean field theory, one would estimate a phase diagram that would look something like this, with superconducting order on this side, a first order phase transition here, and a CDW insulator on this side. Okay?
Okay.
Thank you. Now, I want to make a slight diversion. There's one new thing that we found out in studying this problem. This is an old problem, but there's a new wrinkle on it, which is that if you elaborate the fixed point by including forward scattering interactions between neighboring chains. So you can do that because forward scattering interactions are exactly marginal. So you can still bosonize the problem, and you can still solve this fixed point Hamiltonian exactly. And then what you find is if you do this same analysis of the perturbative relevance of the CDW and superconducting couplings between systems, you find something like this. So here's the axis we had before, where these magic numbers are 0.5, 1, and 2. But here's some measure of the strength of the interchain forward scattering. And what you find is that the interchain forward scatter, so here's this first order boundary between superconductivity and CDW, and you see that this interchain forward scattering tends to stabilize the superconducting state at the expense of the CDW. You can understand that as follows. If I've got a density fluctuation on this chain, that means that I've compressed the CDW here. So it's the CDW phase is progressing a little faster than average here. Now, if I put some Coulomb repulsion between this chain and the next chain, that will tend to make this chain want to have lower density there. So it will tend to stretch out the CDW here. So rather than just having uncorrelated density fluctuations on neighboring chains, this will produce anti-correlated density fluctuations, which means anti-correlated fluctuations of KF, which means it will tend to spoil the phase coherence between the charge density waves on neighboring chains and hence suppress the relevance of CDW. Okay, so that's, of course, important for high-temperature superconductivity, but there's something else that turns out that's really, I think, exciting abstractly, whether it presumably has nothing to do with high-temperature superconductivity, but we found a range where, in fact, nothing is relevant. That is to say that even if I start with an anisotropic but two-dimensional system, it will become more and more one-dimensional as we go to lower and lower energies, and it will become infinitely one-dimensional, a smectic non-Fermi liquid. The
sliding phase.
What? This is a sliding phase, exactly.
This is a bit different from the original Nature paper, right? Basically, kind of from transfer.
Well,
it's
the same. The physics is exactly the same as what we discussed in our Nature paper. I guess that's this one here. And it's the quantum analog of the sliding phase that Lubensky and all discussed at the same time. This is, I think, a nice story because there were absolutely identical developments going on, just one where T was called T and another where it was called X, and one where there was H bar and the other where there was temperature. But they're exactly the same thing. That's a new state of matter. It's a non-Fermi liquid. It's a real, honest-to-God, stable non-Fermi liquid. Very strange one. Okay. Good. Now, let's see. So let me talk a little bit about this issue of Fermi liquid versus non-Fermi liquid spectral functions. So in a Fermi liquid, if I measure the spectral function A of k and omega and say integrate a little window around the Fermi surface, I should find little lines. And of course, we haven't found that. And that's the first indication that what you're dealing with is not a Fermi liquid. But there's something else. If I look, say, let's look along, since it's hard to draw in too many dimensions, let's look at k along some ray in k space that crosses the Fermi surface, what you would expect in a Fermi liquid. So what you would expect is to see some peak that disperses. Here's k and here's omega. And there are two ways people look at these peaks. One is they hold omega fixed and cut through it as a function of k. That's called an MDC. I don't know why I didn't write MDC, but that's sort of the picture of what an MDC would look like. Or they hold k fixed and cut through as a function of energy, and they get the so-called EDC. Now, there are two things about the relation between k and omega. One is that this peak disperses, and from its dispersion, you can derive a velocity, the Fermi velocity. But you can also look at the width of the peak in omega and compare it with the width of the peak in delta k. And the width of the peak in omega is called the scattering rate. That's some sort of inverse lifetime of the excitation. And the width of the peak in k is called the mean free path. That's sort of how far the particle goes before it propagates. And so those widths should be related to each other by the very same velocity as the dispersion. Now, I want to show you a picture of photo emission from optimally doped BISCO. Just because there are two Fermi surface crossings along this line 4. That's why there are two peaks here. So I'm going to move a little bit away to here, to point 3, which is shown here. Now, the gray curves are the normal state, and the left is the EDC, and the right is the MDC. So you see here that there's quite a sharp peak in the momentum distribution curve, and basically no peak in the energy distribution curve. Okay, now you might worry that maybe there's some reason that you can't see sharp peaks in the energy distribution curve here for some reason we haven't thought of. But fortunately, when you go below TC, you see a very sharp peak in the energy distribution curve, so that you know that the width of this peak is for some reason. And there's just no relation between these widths. OK, Catherine, how long should I go on now?
What do you mean?
What? I don't know, 2-3 hours.
Like 10 minutes?
What?
You surely know.
10 minutes.
I hope you do. That if you do the left thing for k significantly above kf, you still get that large thing below mu.
I'm not, what?
That big constant part that you're showing extending down to 3/10 of the volt.
Yeah, okay, I understand what you're saying. You're saying that there's a broad piece here that you see in a large portion of the Brillouin zone. I mean, it is k-dependent, but...
You see it, even when you're scattering. You're supposed to be looking at whole spectra.
What?
You're doing angle.
Yeah.
And you see it when you're when there are no holes. When you're scattering at k significantly above kf.
Chandra, look, these are complicated spectra. I agree with you. The point is that I don't see anything.
If they're complicated spectra, you have to first try to understand the experimental conditions.
Okay.
You don't seem to.
Okay, fine.
But just you don't understand the most elementary thing about the spectra.
But you're also seeing a way when Dennis Lukoff, he showed
that the Argonne guys had some way of subtracting out this flat part, which they regard as background. Quite frankly, I don't understand what they did, but they had some way. Then they did exactly the analysis you wanted and concluded that the energy width and momentum width were precisely related by the same velocities they got from the expression.
I know.
Okay. So do you have a comment on that? Because you want to say it's not true.
Yeah. I just don't think there is, I mean, an ambiguous way of doing that.
Okay.
What?
But now Steve is
not. No, he hasn't.
Wait. Why shouldn't I believe it? That's what I want.
Because it's too much analysis. I mean, you look at the data, there isn't a peak here.
Okay.
But look, well,
we're
not going to settle.
That's fine. I just want to raise the issue.
Yeah, that's fine. let me show you. I'm all scrambled here. Another material. And again. Oh, thanks. And again, here's MDC, which is sharp, and an EDC, which shows nothing. And here's a picture in momentum and energy space. This addresses Chandra's issue. You can see here that all of the spectral weight is confined to below the Fermi surface. It occurs in an asymmetric triangle. And so that here's the broad width of the EDC and the narrow width of the MDC. Okay, and again, this is in a stripe-ordered material. This is in lanthanum, neodymium, strontium, copper oxide.
What?
This is at 15% doped. But it's neodymium 0.6, so it's not superconducting.
It seems to me puzzling that the width of the MDC that you showed on the previous transparency doesn't change at all as you go through TC. You would think the mean free path and these kind of things.
No, it does. It changes extremely dramatically. There's
the width didn't change.
Well, no. What happens?
The peak height changed, right?
So what happens here is that you suddenly get a peak.
The other side, the MDC.
Here.
Yeah, the width doesn't change much at all.
Oh, yeah.
I'm
that
kind of surprised by that.
Okay.
As opposed to transition, why shouldn't the mean free path change?
Okay, well, this isn't a mean free path, obviously.
So what is it?
Okay, I'll tell you. now I'm completely scrambled here. Okay, let me tell you about the spectral function of a one-dimensional electron gas and how you can understand this. Now, again, how much of this is unique to the one-dimensional electron gas and how much of this you would find in another fractionalized spectrum, I don't know. But this is a very non-Fermi liquid spectrum. So let me describe. Here, what I'm doing is I'm putting in some momentum K into the system, and I'm putting in some energy omega into the system. Now, if the spectrum fractionalizes, say, into charge and spin, some of the momentum goes to the spin, and some of the momentum goes to the charge, and some of the energy goes to the spin, and some of the energy goes to the charge. So Vs is the spin velocity, and Vc is the charge velocity. Okay? Now, let's just, for the sake of argument, take the spin velocity to be lower. Okay, now, what we're looking at is not a single particle response function anymore, but a multi-particle continuum, just like you would in a susceptibility. Now it's in a single particle response function. So the first thing you do is you analyze the kinematics to see where you can get response. Okay, so if I put in a certain amount of momentum P, the lowest energy I can do is by putting all of the momentum into the spin and none into the charge. So that's these lines. And then kinematically, I'm allowed anything inside this triangle. Okay, so now what you see is if I scan this at fixed omega, I'm going to see a sharp peak. I'm going to see a sharp peak whose width rises linearly with omega, or temperature, or whatever. But if I scan as a function of omega, what I see is going to depend on the dynamics. There is no kinematic constraints on it. Okay. Now, in one dimension, there are some more complications here. For instance, it turns out that spin rotation invariance implies that the spin Luttinger exponent should be 1. And if that's true, then it turns out you can only make forward-going spin-ons. And so you're going to be confined inside this triangle as opposed to that triangle. If your interactions are weak so that KC is near 1, you're going to have a hard time making backward-going charge excitation, so you'll be confined inside this triangle. There are various different limits one can analyze, but the basic thing that comes from fractionalization, the basic way to look for fractionalization is broad features as a function of energy and sharp features as a function of momentum.
Steve, I guess the case is a little convincing for this stride to a form of TL, right? When you go to optimally doped 2-2-1-2 or something, is it really so dramatically different from, you know, when you look at the data, it seems that the sort of conventional self-energy analysis seems to work quite well.
That's what we were just arguing about.
Yeah.
It doesn't look conventional.
On the nodal fermion.
What?
Focusing
no, I'm staying away from the nodal fermions.
This
picture, yes. So along the diagonal in BISCO, It's the case is much less clear. I agree with you. It's near pi zero that. Here's pictures of EDCs and MDCs for the one-dimensional electron gas. And what I'm going to do now is skip to the end. So I'm not going to tell you about nodal quasiparticles. You'll have to ask me later. I do want to say one more thing though. Two more things. Okay, so here are my two more things. The first thing is that I want to make a second proposal, which is that the non-Fermi liquid character of the normal state, especially in the antinodal regions, and especially in the pseudo-gap regime, is associated with one-dimensional physics on stripes. Okay, so that was the second conclusion. And now I just wanted to end with a few more general thoughts. What I'd like to propose is that this is, in fact, more general than high TC. I think we've had a hard time in numerical studies finding evidence for superconductivity except on certain small clusters. I think there's a reason for that. I think that some sort of mesoscale structure, either self-organized or structural itself, is essential for the mechanism of high temperature superconductivity. And this was something that Shadeep and I proposed actually back in 1991 when thinking about superconductivity in C60. And that moreover, that the way you get superconductivity on small clusters, again, has a general form that if you manage to find some cluster that allows you to have a spin gap due to correlation effects, then you can use that spin gap as a source of superconducting pairing. Okay, now this is clearly related to ideas of short-range RVB. Short-range RVB would say that we can have this without the mesoscale structure, and following Sandi's work and recent work by various people here, you know, maybe it's possible to get the good things of having a spin gap that you dope into without the mesoscale structure. But certainly, it seems much easier to get this by having a mesoscale structure. Let me show you one more example of that. Here, I'm going to consider a mesoscale structure, which is a 4N site Hubbard ring. And I'm going to calculate the spin gap of the neutral molecule with 4N electrons on it. And the pair binding energy, which is the difference in energy of putting one electron on each of two clusters versus putting two electrons on one cluster and none on the other. Now, because of conformal invariance, all of these energies scale with 1 over n. So I've multiplied these energies by n here. Here's for u equals 10 and u equals 20. The circles are the spin gap, and the triangles are the pair binding energy. And so you see, I mean, pair binding energy isn't superconductivity, but it's the sort of thing we want to use to make superconductivity. And so you see that, in fact, they really are the same thing. As large as n gets large, these things up to small corrections are equal to each other. And this is 1,024 is the biggest rings looked at here.
Why are size corrections so strongly different between the two properties?
Because this doesn't involve charge.
Oh, okay.
Right?
Okay.
And so I believe, although we haven't really figured out how to analyze it, because the system is a charge insulator, the leading contribution from the charge degrees of freedom to the pair binding energy goes like 1 over n squared. Okay. Since there are some beta ansatz type people here, it seems to us that there's actually a breakdown of conformal invariance here due to the, you know, marginally irrelevant operator, and this fits better to square root of log n over n. But okay, so the third point then is that these same basic principles of high temperature superconductivity apply not only in the cuprates, but in C60, maybe in anthracene, maybe in other things. And finally, I think that this is really an important part of the problem that's here to stay, that when you have strong correlation effects and you're far from the Fermi liquid in metal physics, that whatever you think of that you think might be good for superconductivity is also good for all sorts of other types of competing order, well, competing or coexisting orders, including charge density waves, spin density waves, electronic liquid crystal, d-density wave of Shadeep and Chaitin and Bob Laughlin. And it would be nice to think, maybe along the lines started by the Su Cheng and his collaborators, that there might be some unified way to treat all of these by rotating between different ordered states. I don't quite know how to do it, but I think that would be a very, very nice way to unify this. Okay.
Steve?
Yeah.
Maybe one word then about going at 45 degrees.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because that seems a problem.
Yeah. Well, so that was the part of the talk that I had to bypass. So if I start with a more elaborate version of this system, in which I have these stripe, I mean, the basic problem is once I have superconductivity locally on a one-dimensional system, I have a gap. And once I have a gap, I don't have nodal quasiparticles, for instance. So the nodal quasiparticles are a big problem. So now let's consider a case where the interstripe piece of the problem comes alive. Let's imagine that it's, in fact, a Luttinger liquid. So here I have a weakly doped system, say with KF near pi over 2, but a little bit less. So this will be a lightly doped single leg ladder, and a heavily doped two leg ladder or three leg ladder, say with KF near pi over 4 and a spin gap. And now I ask what happens as I start turning on couplings between these. Now, because of the spin gap and the mismatches of KFs, many of the couplings between A and B are forbidden. But pair tunneling between A and B is allowed. Now, if pair tunneling between A and B is relevant, then I get a proximity effect and everything gets gapped and that's the end of the story. But suppose pair tunneling between A and B is irrelevant, which is relatively easy to arrange. Under that circumstances, there are no relevant couplings between these two systems. And so if I were to try to follow the renormalization group flows, I would be, here's my decoupled fixed point. All couplings that couple A and B are irrelevant, whereas the couplings that couple A to A and B to B are relevant. Okay, so let's look along this line where I simply ignore the couplings between A and B. Okay, now what happens? Well, what happens is that the A to A coupling, since these are both Luther-Emery liquids, it's either going to become a CdW insulator or a superconductor. Okay, let's take the case where it becomes a superconductor. So this is happily flowing off to a two-dimensional ordered superconductor. We've already treated that problem. What about B? Well, under most circumstances, if this is a Luttinger liquid, the most relevant coupling between those is going to be single particle tunneling. So this is going to busily flow off to an anisotropic but two-dimensional Fermi liquid. Okay, so what will happen is I'll flow to the vicinity of this fixed point. Now, this is still starting with arbitrarily anisotropic system, but I'm going to flow toward a two-fluid fixed point, which consists of a A-chain superconductor and a B-chain Fermi liquid. Okay, and then I now, at this fixed point, of course, I have to redo my analysis. What was irrelevant down here, I know perfectly well is relevant here. That is to say, pair tunneling between a superconductor and a Fermi liquid is not the spin gap proximity effect, it's the proximity effect. Okay, so that's going to flow me to a superconductor. The basic point is that now I'm going to be able to build up the more Fermi liquid-like degrees of freedom that are going to be the answer to your question about what about the diagonal regions out of these Luttinger liquids. And the antinodal non-Fermi liquid pieces of the problem out of these Luther-Emery liquids.
The Fermi liquid has a typical scale that has to be let be carriers of the hop like four or five chains to.
Yeah.
So that would be a very small coupling. The hopping would be quite small.
Yeah.
You expect.
Yeah. Look, I mean.
These are very heavy Fermi liquid.
Well, no, in one direction, in the other direction, it's light. Yeah, look. You know, how literally do you want to take this? Obviously, in the real materials, along the nodal direction, the Fermi surface is two-dimensional. Okay, so these are going to have to be adiabatically continued and are going to change on the way. Okay, this is not a good description. This is, in fact, the world's most awkward description of the nodal quasiparticles. But there was a barrier of adiabatic continuity. If I want to say, I would like to think of the high-temperature superconductors as quasi-one-dimensional. I claim there are a lot of things I understand on the basis of that statement, but one thing I didn't understand at all, which is how come they're nodal quasi-particle excitations at all? Okay. Now what I would like to argue is, of course the system's not so one-dimensional as this. I need to go to this limit to solve it, but reality is more isotropic than that. Some of the features of my analysis are going to be robust. Others are going to get morphed as the system becomes more isotropic. Okay, that's something that you just got to live. At least I've just got to live with. Yeah.
As you also probably know, the spectral function looking different on EDC or MDC is a general property of any self-energy which has different momentum dependence compared to frequency dependence. In particular, if there isn't any momentum dependence and the frequency dependence is linear, that's when you get that thing modulo this experimental background that we talk about. But the line shapes with or without the background are very, very different. So that was something that was predicted in 1989. The related point to that is that certainly it's unarguable in the experimental data that the inelastic part, the part with width varying with temperature, has got the same coefficient in the pi direction as it has at least up to 60 degrees away from the pi direction. So that's an experimental fact, right? Do you agree? It's an experimental fact? You're dividing the pi region of having different physics than other parts.
Chandra, I mean, we should sit down. You're raising serious issues, but they're not issues that we can settle in a minute or two before here. But let me.
You should simply say, hey, I don't understand.
Yeah, just a second, Chandra. I frequently say that, but let me.
I have a serious problem. Help me.
here we go. So look, to start with, if I look at the unanalyzed data, I just look at the data, this in the normal state near the nodal region, I see
a... Just look at the line width of the MD.
No. Sorry, I do. I will find it in a minute. But just bear with me for a minute. Okay, let's first look at unanalyzed data. We look at the unanalyzed data here and the unanalyzed data here. Okay, and I claim that what's going on here looks very different than what's going on here and there. First place, the changes in going through TC here are some pickup of amplitude of this, but no change in width of the peak. Whereas here and here, the peak simply doesn't exist in the normal state. It turns on at TC. Okay? It's just qualitatively different what's going on here and there. Now, what you want me to look at is...
Data plotting delta K versus delta along these different directions.
I'm so scrambled here finding things. It's going to be... There we go. So this is the data you're talking about.
Apart from the uppermost empty triangles, okay, the first four lines that he has drawn four lines through the data, and you see that they have the same slope.
Look, I mean, I agree with you. I can draw a line through this with the same slope. I think within the experimental error, I can also draw something with quite a different slope. I mean, you know, this is analyzed data.
Just stick to 1, 2, 3.
So 3 is clearly on the border between being looking like the nodal direction and looking like the antinodal direction. What?
So that's bad. So now you have proceeded halfway.
Yeah, so somewhere around halfway. And so, remember, 3 occurs right at this border between what I would call the flat antinodal region and the curving diagonal region. I mean,
there's no ambiguity, right? The slope is the same.
I don't agree with you, Chandra, but this is the data.
What a remarkable thing to make one-dimensional models.
Yeah.
This is a more sort of qualitative question that comes back. I think we would all agree that if you, in the physical case that the solid held together up to 10,000 degrees, we would just have a classical gas of essentially conventional excitations.
Yes.
Okay. So, Darren, as one comes down in your picture in temperature, one, the electrons, A, become more quantum mechanical.
Right.
They're sometimes abandoned. And B, at some scale, they sort of start to form these one-dimensional structures.
Right.
So what's the scale where they start to form one-dimensional structures in your thinking? I mean, is it J? Is it T? Is it...
No, well, it's certainly not above J. It's some fraction of J.
Okay.
And presumably doping concentration dependent.
So then why, in the ZS10 data, when he integrates over energies which are basically big compared to J, like 300 millivolts, mm-hmm. you see all this one-dimensional stuff?
There's a conventional idea that ordering at a given temperature should affect spectral response on frequencies of order that temperature. But this is widely violated in highly correlated systems. And so here too, I think that as stripes form, there's no reason for it not to affect the spectrum over big energies. I mean, what I do know, there are some materials where they've been able to do experiments on this, like in the nickelates, as the stripes order, the optical spectrum over ranges of 2 eV changes by order 1.
There's quantum Hall examples where at temperatures of 1/30th of the energy scale change.
Right. So if he had taken his experiments up to a temperature of, say, 1,000 Kelvin and saw the same thing, I would certainly be worried about that. But seeing spectral signatures of these up to high energies, I think, is not necessarily mysterious. It's not that I can calculate that, but...
Can I rephrase Annie's question? Because I think it's a good question. So, in our current understanding, based on TJ models, et cetera, you would seem that, you know, it's half a lecture full or something. You're basically looking at ladder scale physics. It's about a hole doing one half, and it might be half a spin flip or something. Isn't it worrisome that on these short scales, the electrons know already so well that they move, can only move in a one-dimensional fashion?
Wait, on what scale?
On this very short scale. When you do any TJ type calculation, you won't find it, I'm sure.
You just repeat the question.
Okay. When you're looking at electronic structure on a scale of 0.5 eV, half an electron volt, right? And you believe in TJ models, what we all seem to do, then it's basically about processes involving one electron hop and possibly one spin flip or sensing is extremely short distance processes.
No, look, the states of order at order 0.5 eV are near gamma for reasons that have nothing to do with anything. The only thing, I mean, the thing that's striking is the confinement within these barriers up to scale of 0.5 eV. But it doesn't mean the dynamics are still...
When you do a TJ calculation, look on the scale of the lattice constants, these electrons move two-dimensionally.
Yeah, of course, but that's not in conflict with the experiment. The only thing that you see is that even on integrated over scales of 0.5 eV, everything is confined within this stripe, that some of the things near the Fermi energy of tails that continue out a few tens of eV, that doesn't mean that the dynamics on the one lattice scale know about the stripes. Of course they don't, about one-dimensional behavior. Of course on those scales, the dynamics is two-dimensional. And there's no experiment or theory that says otherwise, as far as I know.
I think there is. I mean, when you look at calculated momentum distribution, TJ will be far more two-dimensional, it seems, than what you're seeing in the...
But that's only, the high-energy stuff is near gamma. And so that's confined inside these boundaries anyway, even in a two-dimensional band structure. That doesn't tell you anything one-dimensional.
Yeah, I think we should break your email. Obviously, people who...